Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation along the Columbia River in eastern Washington is the most contaminated nuclear site in the Western Hemisphere. Cleanup of its numerous leaking tanks and unlined pits of radioactive waste has been moving at a glacial pace for 40 years, but now, according to stories from Hanford workers who are demolishing Hanford's plutonium finishing plant, things are even getting worse. Today, we talk with Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with Hanford Challenge and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about the latest contamination incidents at Hanford and what it will take to get this cleanup back on track. Liz, welcome to Locus Focus, and Tom and Dan, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with this recent incident. There was a collapse of this tunnel that they were working on, and there was some release of radiation, and the contractor said, no problem, nothing escaped. And then another one in December, which sounds like it was much worse. And I'm not sure if there's been anything since then, but let's talk a little bit about what that shows about this mythological cleanup of the Hanford Reservation. And I'll start with Tom.
All right. So, we're talking several incidents, actually. The first that people probably read about or heard about was the partial collapse of the Purex tunnel, which is a radioactive waste storage tunnel that happened in April. And scientists had warned that that might happen, but they weren't quick enough to get on top of it. So fortunately, it doesn't appear to have been a big release of contamination from that, although there certainly could have been. But then separately, they're tearing down this facility that you just talked about, the plutonium finishing plant, and actually part of that called the plutonium reclamation facility. And they've had three releases beyond the safe zones or boundaries in 2017 from that facility. Two of them were bad enough that they contaminated workers. The first one that did that was in June, and about 31 workers turned up positive for plutonium in their bodies after testing from that incident. And then and there was another one in December where their numbers are still coming in, but it looks like now we're up to 40 workers have tested positive. And there were some other, contaminated vehicles that apparently were driven into town, including a rental car, and they found out after the fact. So this was a very, serious set of incidents that happened at the plutonium finishing plant, in particular involving, a release of plutonium, from its contained area and out into the population. And I think the worst sin was that they didn't notice that it had happened in time to actually protect people. And then it kept happening. So it was more than one incident. There was a series of warnings.
So why didn't they know that it had happened?
Well, they assumed that they had contained it and failed to look in all the places where they should have looked. So, for instance, they looked in around the fences and the immediate area. They found some contamination and cleaned it up, missed the fact that contamination had traveled to the parking lot and landed on workers' cars and company cars. So there's like 36, I think, vehicles acknowledged to have been contaminated and seven private vehicles. Subsequently, by the way, the Washington Department of Health released some data showing that plutonium was found on a sensor 10 miles away that they say is from the plutonium finishing plant. And that's near the river, the K Basins area. And they also found contamination on a sensor next to the highway that goes through the middle of the site, Route 240. So there was there's some alarm about, well, how much plutonium actually did escape from there. And Hanford has been pretty tight-lipped about that in terms of releasing any data about how many plutonium particles might have escaped, whether or not that's traveled into the communities, whether other workers were contaminated besides those that were tested.
Well, going back to the early 80s, when I started doing some work on Hanford, Well, in the early 80s, they're still trying to build more plutonium processing plants, and they still were trying to get the N reactor, which was going to be a hybrid plutonium-producing reactor plus a power reactor. And had all kinds of great plans. The next time I was up there was several years later when they were starting the cleanup, and I've been there a couple times since. And every time you go up there and you have to go through, you know, this workshop before they let you onto the reservation and you get your badge. And the whole mission that they talk about is cleanup. And this I've heard this talk several times now. And how it's cleanup, and it's basically security about releases. Back in the early 80s, the concern was that radiation was escaping or would escape into the groundwater, which it hadn't actually done. And then there was a discovery a few years later that there was all this toxic chemicals as well as radiation that was also and was escaping into the groundwater. But this seems to be on a whole new level where we're not just concerned about radiation that's been buried escaping, but it seems like it's getting loose again. And what is the cause for this?
Who do you want for
this? I'll go for Liz.
Yeah.
Well, one of the main problems with the demolition of the plutonium finishing plant is doing an open-air demolition. There is some precedent for tenting sites like that to contain the contamination so that it doesn't spread, and that decision wasn't made for this this cleanup. So that's definitely a big concern for us, looking at that. That would have been a way to prevent this from happening.
So who is overseeing all of this, Dan?
You know, the Federal Department of Energy is overseeing this. And I think one of the things that really struck me about this story, about the plutonium finishing plant, it's something that Hanford Challenge has done incredible work in empowering workers who are impacted by this sort of thing to come out and speak up, was the potential role of kind of meeting cleanup deadlines in forcing the timeline here and kind of racing ahead. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts, Liz and Tom, about that, whether you think that really played kind of a key role in the spread of contamination there. Because that was one of the more jarring conclusions of the recent report from King 5.
Yes, the contractor was on a very definite schedule with a set of milestones and money attached to achieving those milestones. So, you know, what they call fee, the rest of us call bonuses. They were supposed to have this accomplished by the end of 2017, maybe before. And then they had $52 million at stake, right? So that they could have earned. At some point, when they started falling behind, the penalties start setting in against that $52 million. And at first, it's like $15,000 a day, and then it goes to $25 or $30. And this year, I think in May, it gets to $147,000 a day. So they run out of profit, basically, or bonus. So they were very motivated to take shortcuts, dismiss, the evidence in front of their eyes, to make assumptions that weren't, as conservative as they should have been, given the circumstance. And I blame that partially on the fact that the Department of Energy put in place a contract that allowed this to happen or drove that behavior and then failed to oversee, the project when they had the first release, which was actually February of 2017, beyond the boundaries. There probably should have been a halt of the work and then said, okay, we need a tent after all. But they didn't do that. And then in June, they had the second incident contaminating 31 people, and that still was not enough. They didn't tent the facility, and they didn't take the appropriate steps to protect the workers or to prevent a release. And finally, in December, it happened again, this time with a pretty severe release, And you just wonder, well, what does it take to get the government and these companies to step back and do what's necessary? But the Department of Energy kind of created this monster, I think, and it ended up very unfortunately for a whole bunch of workers who are now worried about whether or not their health will be affected down the road.
Well, one of the concerns that I have is I'm thinking throughout this whole history of Hanford's cleanup that there's been this push-pull between the government and the contractors dragging it out and, on the other hand, trying to rush it. I know back in the 80s, there was they kept pushing back the deadlines and pushing back the deadlines. And I mean, it was all supposed to be cleaned up about 20 years ago. So on the one hand, it's going very slowly and nothing's happening. And on the other hand, the complaint is that it's being rushed. So how does that get mediated? And I'll let Liz answer that one.
Yeah, that's I think one of the biggest challenges of Hanford cleanup is there are sometimes good reasons to slow things down and do it right, and there are other times when the reasons that the cleanup's going so slowly are man-made problems that come from the way that the cleanup project was scoped and. It makes it hard to negotiate how to make sure that the cleanup's done safely and effectively and workers are protected, like in this instance, when it was appropriate to slow things down to intent the site and protect workers and just stop when there was an incident. And then there's other times, and the waste treatment plant's a great example of that, where there were a series of bad decisions that led to these delays that go on and on and on. So I think there are a lot of different factors at play that cause this dynamic to happen at Hanford. And Tom might have some more thoughts on that.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with Hanford Challenge and Dan Sears with the Columbia Riverkeeper about the latest contamination incidents at Hanford Nuclear Reservation. And Tom, I'll let you follow up on what Liz just said.
Liz made great points. I guess I would just maybe add that the cleanup has turned into a fraud fest in a way for contractors. There's been a lot of cheating going on. Companies, contractors that have been caught bilking the U.S. taxpayer by, making up numbers, making up time card issues, they've been prosecuted. They've been fined. They've pled guilty. One company that did that, CH2M Hill, is still working at the site, amazingly. So they didn't really feel a consequence from it, except from, those things that I just mentioned. But, they quickly, I'm sure, made up the... by the way, that's the same company that was in charge of the project at the plutonium finishing plant. On the other hand, Bechtel and URS settled a fraud claim to the tune of $125 million by the government. They had to pay that money to the government to settle allegations of fraud connected with the waste treatment plant. And there are other, ongoing kind of claims like that. But even looking at the Government Accountability Office, GAO, they've done study after study after study and said, man, this place is managed really badly. There's a lot of mismanagement. There's a lot of incompetence. And, frankly, the system is broken. And, I've long said that probably the Department of Energy should not be in charge of the cleanup. They should have to pay for it. But they are a national security agency in charge of our making materials for nuclear weapons. They made the mess at Hanford. They lied about it. They've got a terrible history of environmental degradation, worker health and safety problems, et cetera, and yet they're running the cleanup pretty much in the same way, and so we're not getting the truth out of them, very often. So it's usually Hanford Challenge or King 5 or Columbia Riverkeeper that's, putting the news out about something going wrong at the site because the site is not in a habit of talking about its issues and problems.
You know, one of the points to follow on that, Tom, and maybe Liz, you could speak to this as well, is the real risk of ingesting plutonium, which, you know, I always just floored to see Department of Energy downplay what happens in the body when you have plutonium ingested or inhaled. It seems like it should go without saying that that's a bad thing to have plutonium inside your body. And yet, you know, for instance, the King 5 story and other places that it's been reported that worker, you know, at least one worker was very disturbed to see DOE compare that to a plane flight to Philadelphia. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to what people are experiencing and kind of the long-term health risk from doing this very important work at Hanford.
I actually want to add on to Dan's question. These issues came up throughout the period of cleanup and before that. There have been many instances where workers were contaminated back in the 50s and 60s, 70s and 80s. So I wonder how the recent contaminations kind of fall into place with a long history of workers being contaminated at Hanford.
Well, that's a great question. I'll answer yours first, Barbara, which is, yeah, there have been contamination incidents. I can't recall one where 45 people, you know, ended up with plutonium in their bodies. It usually happened in, like, three people got contaminated or whatever. So it's not unheard of. And especially in the earlier days, certainly there was, you know, especially the people working in the reactors, they would get so hot, the reactors would create neutron radiation. It was not well controlled. It's hard to control neutron. And that's the kind of radiation that makes other things radioactive, so as opposed to a particle that you inhale. This actually, you know, so the salt in workers' body was being converted to sodium-24. So workers who did whole body counts, because that's what they did back then, on a weekly basis for the reactor workers, they just quit looking for sodium-24 because it just overwhelmed the whole body counter. So they turned off that function. And, you know, these workers are very sick now. But in more recent memory, this is a huge incident. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find anywhere in this country or in any other site around the world where 45 workers inhale plutonium. Now, it is true that Hanford officials have been downplaying the risks and comparing it to half a chest x-ray or a plane flight. However, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that they make that, you know, self-serving assumptions that Hanford has made in making these claims. So they assume a particle size that is larger than maybe it is. They assume that there were no high-fired oxides. So they took the tests for these workers sometimes weeks and weeks after when they should have taken the test, which is within 2 days. So we don't have a real clear picture of how many people really got contaminated, where that contamination is in their body, what kind of contamination. And experts say, you know, plutonium in your lung, that's just not a good day, right? There's a huge amount of risk associated with a plutonium particle giving off alpha particles millions of times a second in the very sensitive lung tissue. Especially if it goes into the deep lung, your body is not very good at cleansing that kind of material from your lung. And it can also go other places in your body, of course. So I think they were quick to want to say it's not so bad, when in fact the jury is really out on that.
Well, I want to get back to this whole idea about the Department of Energy basically patrolling itself. And there's back in 1982, when I did my first story on Hanford, it was there was a big question in the anti-nuclear movement at the time was the Department of Energy, which was kind of a relatively new division having split off from the Atomic Energy Commission a few years earlier, that there was that they were really culpable for what was going on. And this is, I guess this is also at least a kind of a sister question to this, which is like, why has this just gone on for so long? And it seems like the easy answer is, yes, the Department of Energy has been in charge. So I just wonder about the challenge of getting another agency involved, and if it's possible for instance, the Department of Ecology in Washington, which has taken a much stronger step lately than it did back in the 80s and 90s. But is there another agency or agencies that could actually take charge of the cleanup?
There's a model in Britain where when the military says we're done with the nuclear facility, then they leave. And the British government created a cleanup commission whose job it was to, you know, make sure that a cleanup happened at the facility in concert with the values and principles of the affected stakeholders. And, you know, that includes basically everyone who cares. That could be the local communities, labor, environmental groups, et cetera, that all have a stake in the outcome of this cleanup. And so that's the idea behind that. And, you know, I kind of think that Hanford could have the same kind of thing, maybe a port commission type of approach where commissioners maybe represent different parties out there, tribes, communities, environmental groups, people who use the river, impacted communities, agriculture, and have a say, have a seat or a position, and perhaps suggested by the governors of Oregon and Washington, and then appointed by the president, et cetera, and serve for a period of terms. You know, port commissions are able to, make contracts and oversee those contracts, and then the whole thing subject to federal law, right? So there would be regulation by the state of Washington, certainly, like there is now, and maybe more so, and the EPA, and probably the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as well, to go after the, and not that they're, any great shakes, but they're a lot better than the Department of Energy has ever been.
Well, Liz, I'm wondering.
That's one model.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Liz, if there's been any difference in the pace and the quality of the cleanup at Hanford under different presidential administrations. Because one of the things that people complain to me when I've been out there is that every political administration changes the game and moves the marker back to zero again. And like, for instance, it took them, I don't know how long, to come to an agreement to do glass vitrification. And I'm not even sure they're still doing that, but that took at least 10 years, and they would develop it to a point, and then the next presidential administration would come in and pull the plug. Has there been any measurable difference between when Nixon was president or when Reagan was president or when Clinton or Bush or Obama or now Trump?
This is probably a better question for Tom. I think my take on progress through administrations is really that no one has cracked the code for Hanford. No one, the systemic problems that cleaning up nuclear waste on this scale present and having an annual budget to accomplish that cleanup creates a lot of political problems that no one has solved. There have been some measurable differences when there was when there's extra funding that can accelerate certain projects, and Tom would have a better sense of throughout time, since he's been working on this longer than I have, over the last 35 plus years.
So what's your perspective, Tom, from the last few eons that you've been involved with Hanford?
Liz is right. The system is what it is, and it produces what it does, and that's mostly profits for contractors and jobs for the community, and not much in the way of cleanup. So recently the GAO put out a report on tank waste cleanup. It's high level waste, and made the remark that, hey, you guys have spent about $19 billion on trying to deal with this high-level waste in these tanks, then that's $19 billion, and not one teaspoon of waste has been treated, much less, you know, disposed of somewhere. So it seems like we're even farther behind every day that we go with that project. Of course there have been better days. I really enjoyed the administration of Hazel O'Leary back in the Clinton days, back in the 90s, because of her, you know, drive toward openness and protecting whistleblowers. And she also had issues and problems. And, there's been no magic bullet and no formula that's been applied that really has resulted in getting the progress that we'd all love to see at Hanford.
Well, it seems like whistleblowers have been a major part of getting anything out at all. Is that true, Dan?
It seems from my perspective that that's the case. There are some things that you can see through the environmental monitoring, things like, you know, the radiation reaching groundwater, different types of radioactive pollution. But when it comes to the things that get released into the air, this issue of plutonium or americium blowing 10 miles across the site is really eye-opening. We take people down the river every summer, and, you know, we're paddling right by those K reactors, and hasn't really been in the forefront of our minds that, you know, we could be breathing something in the air that's coming from 10 miles away at the plutonium finishing plant, but it should be now. And I think one of the things that's super interesting about this time is whether the agencies involved are really seeking the public's engagement and involvement with this problem. From my perspective, it seems like, you know, we beat this drum of things are bad and getting worse at Hanford, but that is actually the motivation for investing in the kind of cleanup that will actually protect the Columbia River and protect future generations who are going to use this area. And it's something that, you know, I know Liz has had a lot of involvement with, trying to draw out the agency so that they actually solicit public involvement and public comment. And it's been a real challenge in recent years. So that's one place where I think we're falling short.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Dan Sears, who you just heard, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson up in Seattle with Hanford Challenge about the challenges of trying to clean up Hanford. Well, Dan, I'm thinking as a representative of Columbia Riverkeeper, why Hanford? This is like one of your first portfolio, one of the first items in your portfolio, Columbia Riverkeeper. And why Columbia Riverkeeper is so concerned about Hanford and how that compares to all the other kind of more recent horrors that you've been fighting, like oil trains and oil terminals and liquid natural gas and things like that.
Hanford is, you know, the problem that's going to be there forever. You know, it seems, at least from my perspective and my generation. I think one of the things that we find really motivating about Hanford right now is the necessity to teach the next generation what is there and what's happened, because there's a real risk of a lot of knowledge being lost and fading away, as people who maybe had access to the site, you know, they're mostly passing on. And the people, you know, who are very involved with production on the site, many of them are aging and even passing away. So I think that there's this real risk that we could walk away from Hanford and not realize that what we're leaving to the next generation and the generation after that is a soil column that's heavily polluted with chemicals and radionuclides that are dangerous. Many square miles of groundwater that are contaminated above drinking water levels, and a Columbia River shoreline that still is populated with the hulking husks of defueled reactors, and beneath them quite a bit of contamination that poses a long-term risk to the Columbia River. So from our perspective, it's very important to keep people engaged. One of the places where we've seen leadership through many generations has been from the tribal nations, who have a much longer-term view. You know, I'm a relative newcomer to Hanford cleanup, having been involved since really 2009, and certainly a newcomer when it comes to engagement with this part of the Columbia River. And I think what's fascinating is to look back through many decades and to see how people have envisioned a cleaner future for this part of the Columbia River. And, you know, that's inspiring, and it's actually led to progress in many places where we've seen groundwater pumped and treated, and in many cases, a lot of contamination removed. We've seen things like hexavalent chromium dug up, where they realized that it was just moving too fast and getting to the river, that their only real solution was to dig it up and mine it out and move it away from the Columbia River. So progress is possible in protecting the Columbia River, and that's one of the things that we think is very important to also convey. You know, with the right investment in Hanford cleanup, we can do real things to protect the environment and protect the Columbia River, which is, in case anyone forgets, this is the most important main stem spawning habitat for Chinook salmon in the entire Columbia River system.
And it's the last undammed reach of the Columbia River below the 49th parallel.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really a beautiful, amazing place. When you float down the Hanford Reach, you see salmon spawning, you see all kinds of wildlife, and you see the legacy of our nuclear weapons production. So I really see Hanford as being one of the really existential risks for the Columbia River and our salmon fishery.
Well, one of the things that I'm concerned about is I'm not sure how many people who have recently moved to the Portland area are even aware of Hanford. And I was just thinking about when I found out about Hanford, and I was traveling back to Portland from the East Coast, and I got a ride with this guy who was actually a nuclear engineer. And he was a very sweet guy. And he, even though he was going to Hanford, that's where he was going to work, he drove me all the way to Portland and then drove back to Hanford the same day. And so he told me a little bit about Hanford and this place that he was working, and it sounded, he was very romantic about it because he thought it would be like Los Alamos during World War II. And I thought, sounds interesting. And then over the next few years, stories started leaking out in the news about all these leaks at Hanford, and I started realizing this place this guy had told me about was really a major problem. And then a few years later, it became one of my missions to do stories about it. Now, but it seems like Hanford keeps, you know, it's kind of like tidal, and there's like this big wave of stories about Hanford, and then it recedes. And so people who've come to Portland in the last couple of years might have not known anything about Hanford till last spring, and then it's very hard to catch up. I'm wondering if what's going on right now is, in terms of arousing public consciousness, might be akin to what's going on with the gun control movement after the massacre in Florida last week, when suddenly all these high school students are taking the lead and trying to really create a powerful gun control movement. And maybe if something like that can happen, if there's a way to take control of this message that's coming out that Hanford is really a disaster. I mean, it's a disaster that isn't waiting to happen. It's happening right now. And to up the momentum to really make a change in how Hanford's cleaned up. And I'll let you all take turns and responding to that. Sure, why don't you start, Tom?
All right. So, I mean, the short answer is I think there is awareness growing, but you're absolutely correct that it comes and goes. So because it's in the news a lot, then, you know, more people get interested and want to do, for instance, you know, talk show interviews, and it gets in the paper more, and there's more public meetings, and then it gets quiet, and it fades. So having been a part of, you know, Hanford oversight since 1986 and nuclear oversight since 1978, you know, I'm used to this happening. What really gets people's attention is when, you know, they feel that they might be at risk. So you know, when the river is at risk, obviously Portland gets drinking water from the river. There's a lot of communities downstream. Besides that, there's a lot of people who eat fish and enjoy the river for various reasons. But then there's the air releases. And, you know, there have been not many of those since cleanup started, and nothing very serious apart from what just happened with the plutonium. When people feel that they are at risk, then, you know, there's a response. I was, you know, on the phone with a columnist in the Seattle Times last week, and he goes, "What's it going to take, Tom, to you know, make Hanford cleanup safer?" And I said, well, you know, like anything else in society, it takes a big crisis. You know, it's going to take a big release or, you know, a fire explosion that exposes, you know, this problem in a big way. And he goes, what, 45 people getting, you know, contaminated internally isn't enough? And I said, no, that's not enough. People have to feel more threatened by it than that. And, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about this and what it's going to take. Well, either that's going to happen or there's going to be, you know, an administration that comes in that takes all this a lot more seriously and puts in place a better system and the appropriate amount of money to really start making progress out there.
What's your thoughts, Liz?
I'm just thinking about your metaphor with the your comparison with the gun control movement, and I think like one major difference is Hanford isn't something that's in most people's daily life experience to think about being in a place that is the most contaminated nuclear waste site in the Western Hemisphere. To have that in your body and your consciousness is very different than, you know, people that are in schools, you have children, or you know children in schools, you have a visceral experience of this happened somewhere else to someone else's children, this could happen to my children. For Hanford, it's a very out of sight, out of mind problem, which makes it very difficult to keep long-term attention and focus and energy and momentum on, for all the reasons that Dan so eloquently mentioned earlier. I think the tribes have a really amazing role in seeing this long view and having having a sense of time that's so much more expansive than the way that Hanford has been contextualized in the way we've set cleanup milestones and the way we address problems and plan for the future. There's a plutonium contamination incident, and then there's a lot of attention and media focus on it, and then eventually that drops off and people forget, because it's hard to keep focus on something that is going to take another 75 to 100 years to clean up. That time frame is very hard for people to hold on to, and it's so important that we do keep that momentum and energy, because you want to actually make progress with cleaning up a site like this. You don't want to be babysitting the waste, which is a lot of what we're paying for right now, as Tom was talking about with the tank waste that's sitting in these aging, failing underground tanks. We don't want that waste escaping those tanks more than it already has, because once it gets in the ground, it's going to eventually get in the river, and it may be 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now that it's affecting future generations, and we need to prevent that now. And that's a hard problem to make people feel a lot of urgency around.
And what do you think, Dan? You're maybe the youngster in the room. But
I think Liz and I are almost the same age, which makes us the youngsters. Okay. at the Hanford Advisory Board meetings. And that's, I think, one of the challenges I see is, you know, we, with keeping attention and keeping momentum, it's actually been a long time since the Department of Energy held a public meeting outside of the Tri-Cities. This is something that Liz has brought up repeatedly, you know, at Hanford Advisory Board meetings, and others have joined in and really called for the agencies to solicit input and to invite people to become knowledgeable and participate in this process, which is going to last many decades more. Without that sort of reaching out from the Hanford area, we risk losing many, you know, potential great advocates for the Columbia River and for a cleaner environment at Hanford. And we've seen, at least in my experience, in the last several years, there's been a real dearth of outreach in the broader region. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important for groups like Hanford Challenge in Seattle and Riverkeeper, where we are on the lower Columbia River. You know, we go further upriver too, but a lot of our members are down here. We're trying to spread the word because, you know, it needs to get out of eastern Washington, where a lot of people are aware of the risks and concerned about them and concerned about the drinking water. You know, seeing, for instance, the Tri-City Herald editorialize very forcefully about not cutting the budget at Hanford, you know, that they have a lot in common with people down here in Portland who, if they knew what Tri-City Herald knew, would be very alarmed about a $130 million cut to the Hanford budget.
Actually, we're going to get to that in a little bit. But I'm just wondering how, because it used to be that the community in the Tri-Cities area was very dependent on Hanford for jobs and did not want to, I mean, you know, they wouldn't want to have the budget cut, but they also were not really wanting to be focusing on cleanup. They were wanting to build more nuclear projects back in the early 80s. I'm wondering if things have changed, if there's a possibility of building more alliances between people in the Tri-Cities and people who are downstream from Hanford.
You know, I guess I can just speak from my own experience. I guess I've been surprised at times how often, for instance, on the Hanford Advisory Board, we come to consensus on what seem like common sense but fairly challenging topics around cleanup. And there are people from the Tri-Cities, actually most of the board, I would say, at least half the board is really comes from that area of Washington. And I think there is pretty broad consensus around the idea that we should not allow plutonium to be blowing off the site, and we shouldn't be allowing very dangerous chemicals and radionuclides to percolate through the soil into groundwater and into the Columbia River. So I think there is a region-wide desire for robust cleanup. How we get there has been, you know, at times a point of difference. But at least from my perception, I do see maybe more than in previous iterations, this desire to see Hanford addressed in a really meaningful way. And I don't know if Tom, if you have a different perception than that with your longer experience.
Actually, I'm going to need to have you hold that thought for a moment, Tom, because I need to let the listeners know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG FM, LPFM in Seattle. We're talking today about the unending process of trying to clean up the very, very contaminated Hanford Nuclear Reservation in eastern Washington, just about 218 miles upstream from us here in Portland. And we're talking with Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with the Hanford Challenge up in Seattle, and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper, who's in the studio with me. So, Tom, do you have a response to what Dan just said?
Well, certainly the community has changed a lot over the last 30 years in their outlooks. And I think there's, you know, been a, most folks have given up on seeing Hanford go back into the business of making plutonium or having a role basically in plutonium making or other nuclear stuff except for cleanup. So I think there's been a big move to embrace the cleanup. They care about especially protecting the groundwater, protecting their communities. They're turning to winemaking, vineyards, and looking for other ways to, keep the Tri-Cities healthy. So that's been very, very encouraging. And, Liz works on the Hanford Advisory Board and does a lot of bridge building with communities there. And she's a lot more qualified than me to talk about the current state of affairs, if you want to say something.
Sure. What do you say, Liz?
I think there's a great deal of agreement and shared concern across a lot of different political ideologies. And I think the main difference and the challenge is in the public sphere and in tactics for how Hanford is addressed publicly. There's a really big disagreement around what will instill a sense of urgency and will keep funding and concern and attention on Hanford. There's kind of two sides, and there's lots of gray area around accentuate the positive and talk about all the great things that are happening to keep the funding coming, and then there's the other side of you have to talk about all of the challenges and all the bad things that are happening to justify the incredible expense that is needed to address this massive amount of radioactive and chemical waste that needs to be removed and treated and stored and kept out of the environment so that humans and animals in the environment are safeguarded from these contaminants. And in a lot of smaller groups or in hallway conversations, you'll find incredible agreement around what the problem is and shared concern. And for some reason, and it's probably historical, there's a lot of challenge getting on the same page for tactics politically, and they're usually politically motivated, which is very challenging in my the time I've been working on Hanford since 2007. Seeing that agreement and potential for alliance building get held up by that disagreement over how to publicly get attention on cleanup and move forward.
Well, it seems that one thing you might all be in agreement about is Trump's plans to cut the budget of Hanford's cleanup way back. So let's talk a little bit about that. And how much does Trump want to cut it back? Why does he want to cut it back? And what would the consequences be?
So I think I said $130 million. That's wrong. It's $230 million.
I'm
missing $100 million, which, you know, is in any other cleanup effort, not a rounding error. So, yeah, I think that what's jarring to me about it is what you lose for $230 million is a really significant amount of active work. One thing that's come up over and over is the aging infrastructure at Hanford, you know, the Purex tunnels, for instance, collapsing on their own under the weight of, you know, decades of radiation decaying away the material there. There are problems like that around Hanford, maybe not quite on that scale, but many problems where the infrastructure of the site itself is at risk of failing, you know, with the leaking tanks, with things like Purex tunnels. So when you cut $230 million, you're paring it down to really just the amount of the budget that's hoteling, like Liz said, that's babysitting the waste. And it doesn't leave you the ability to go and actively do the type of cleanup that's really urgently needed in facilities like the Purex tunnels or the waste encapsulation storage facility, where, you know, 1936 highly radioactive capsules are sitting in an aging concrete pool of water. These are urgent matters that could pose a risk not just to people right at Hanford, but to the region.
These are urgent matters that have been going on for 40 years or more. I mean, maybe in some cases, 60, 70 years.
And, you know, we're simply not going to get there with cleanup if we don't fund it properly. And $230 million cuts very deeply, particularly into the Richland Operations Office, which is responsible for a lot of the work that we find very important in the river corridor and in protecting groundwater and addressing soil contamination.
So what does this say to you about what Trump's motivations are? I'll let Tom answer that.
Well, I mean, I think Trump is trying to cut, you know, government spending. And so he, you know, his proposal cuts about 10% out of Hanford cleanup, while raising the amount of money that we would be spending on nuclear weapons. So there's just this huge buildup now for especially, you know, usable nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons that can be used in a tactical way. And that's very disturbing. At the same time, you know, cutting the cleanup at these sites, and not just Hanford, but other sites as well. So it's, you know, fortunately, it is a proposed budget. Congress will come up with its own budget. Rarely does, if ever, does the president's budget actually make it right to the to what is the budget. It's Congress does, that's its job. But it does say something about the priorities of the administration that it would cut. And one thing to add to what Dan was saying is, you know, and what you're saying too, Barbara, is, you know, this is an aging infrastructure. Hanford was largely built in the 1940s and 50s. That's a long time ago. You know, we're talking 60 years ago or 70 years ago, and these buildings were not designed to last this long. You know, it's falling to pieces. The tanks, every single tank should be out of service, but they're not. They're holding two-thirds of the nation's high-level waste. We are living on borrowed time at Hanford. We cannot afford to ignore the fact that doing nothing is not an option because they will fail. These facilities will fail in and of themselves. The concrete will give away. The electrical systems, the piping, all of that is at severe risk. So now this is not the time to cut. In fact, the Department of Energy itself has said you need more money for cleanup just to be in compliance right away. And the Hanford Advisory Board has recommended essentially doubling the amount of money that goes into Hanford just to get things under control. But we're far away from that right now, and that's worrisome because it could all catch up to us.
Well, as I'm sitting here, I've been thinking about all the issues I've been involved in since I came to Oregon in 1971. And I think the only one that I was involved in, not in 71, but soon afterwards, that I'm still involved in, is Hanford. I mean, the other things have either become non-issues, have been solved, wars have ended, new wars have started. But there's something about the continuity of Hanford being a serious, more than serious problem, is very disturbing. And I wonder, how do we move from that to make Hanford, to make a change so that maybe 10 or 15 years from now, we can look at what's going on with Hanford and go, it's not the same problem as it was back in 1948 or 1972 or 1983?
I mean, I would say two big things that need to change are investment and how we manage that investment. And around the investment and the budgeting of Hanford, it poses a really big challenge for people managing the cleanup, and for and there's a really big misconception about how that money is spent and how much money is needed at Hanford to actually accomplish cleanup, which I'll define as removing, treating, and storing waste so that it's not spreading through the environment. So there's two offices at Hanford. The Richland operations side that Dan explained accomplishes the work along the river where all the reactors are and some of the lab facilities. And then there's some sites in the middle of the Hanford site, the Central Plateau, that the Richland Operation Office oversees. And their funding is separate from the Office of River Protection, which is responsible for Hanford's tank waste and treating that tank waste. And one kind of revelation that's come up in the past few years is that about $700 million of the Richland Operation budget is actually not used for cleanup in the sense of removing, treating, and storing that waste. It's used for managing the infrastructure, paying for surveillance, keeping things safe on site, restoring water mains, repairing pipes, all of those services which aren't cleanup. So when you cut back from that budget and you're looking at a $2.2 billion budget for the whole site, say you only give Richland Operations Office $850 million, that's only $150 million that can be used for cleanup, and that's what extends the timeline for Hanford way past what it should be and makes it hard to actually get projects accomplished. And I think that's a big part of why it's hard to get that investment. And then the other side is managing that cleanup money and making sure that the investment is used responsibly, which I think Tom can talk to very
well. Actually, we're just about out of time, and I just wanted to have, like in 30 seconds, maybe have Dan talk about what can people do to get involved?
Yeah, it's an important time. So through Hanford Challenge, through Columbia River Keeper, you know, there are opportunities to weigh in with some of these really key cleanup decisions. For instance, you know, there are hundreds of people who weighed in about the capsule storage at the waste encapsulation storage facility, which is this one of these really high-risk facilities at Hanford. There's going to be an opportunity. It's actually open right now to address how the Purex tunnels are cleaned up. And so, you know, decision by decision, people can weigh in. And then there's this more foundational debate that's going on right now about how we will restructure the tri-party agreement, kind of the overall cleanup plan. And right now, the word is there's going to be massive proposed delays in Hanford cleanup. The last time we saw delays at cleanup, what we had almost immediately after was the collapse of the Purex tunnels. And so it's a really important time to spread the word and to weigh in with our members of Congress and these agencies not to further delay and to get about the business of actually doing the cleanup.
So to do that, you can go onto the Locus Focus website, and we have links to Columbia Riverkeeper and to Hanford Challenge, and that'll put you in motion to solve this problem. So I want to thank Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper and Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with Hanford Challenge for joining us. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll
talk about this again pretty soon, I'm sure. We've been talking with Tom Carpenter and Liz Mattson with the Hanford Challenge and Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you'd like your family or friends to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll be talking with Judy McCaffrey and Shirley Walsh about the never-ending saga of the Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos Bay. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Gerald Biafro. Thanks for listening.
To get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother. Be careful.